kid on a bike, rode down the wooden pier, looking for nothing, expecting nothing. He heard voices from the cabin of a fishing boat and eased closer to listen. Strange voices in another language, English. He rode away, finally went home, where his mother was looking for him, and told her. She was angry and smacked him about the ears. Such a strange kid, always telling tall tales and exaggerating. Chapter 30. Amato and his sons arrived at dawn as the harbor came to life. Of the three, Teofilo was the tallest, but only slightly, maybe 5'8". His clothing would fit neither Pete, who was 6'2", nor Clay, who was an inch shorter. Length was the problem, not the waistlines. The Americans were so gaunt that their belts could almost make two loops around. Last night after dinner, Amato had visited the home of a friend, a man believed to be the tallest man in town. He had negotiated the purchase of two pairs of work pants and two khaki work shirts, along with two pairs of socks. The man at first refused to sell his meager clothing, which was practically his entire wardrobe, and would consider doing so only if Amato divulged what was going on. When the tall man realized who needed the clothing, he refused to accept money. He sent his best wishes along with his clothes. Amato's wife then washed and ironed the outfits, and as he proudly pulled them from his rucksack and laid them on a cot in the cabin, he had tears in his eyes. So did Pete and Clay. Amato went on to say that he had been unable to secure new boots. American feet are long and narrow. Filipino feet are short and wide. Only one store in town sold footwear, and the merchant almost certainly stocked nothing for foreigners. Amato apologized profusely. Pete finally asked him to stop and said they had an important matter to discuss. They desperately wanted to write letters to their wives. They had had no contact since before Christmas, and they knew their families were worried sick. They considered this a simple request, but Amato didn't like it. He explained that mail service was unreliable and being watched closely by the Japanese. There were thousands of American soldiers on the loose throughout the Philippines, men just like them, and everyone wanted to send a letter home. Very little mail was allowed to leave the islands. The enemy had a noose around everything. The postal clerk in San Narciso owned the grocery store, and they suspected he was a sympathizer. If he, Amato, handed him two letters written by Americans, there would be serious trouble. The mail was too risky. Pete pressed him and asked if it was possible to mail the letters from another town. Amato finally yielded and sent Tomas into the village. He returned with two sheets of flimsy onion paper and two small square envelopes. Amato found a piece of a pencil. Sitting at the small folding table in the cabin, Pete wrote, "Dear Liza, we surrendered on April 10th, and I've spent the last 3 months or so as a POW. I escaped and am now fighting as a guerrilla somewhere on Luzon. I have survived a lot and will continue to survive the rest, and I'll be home as soon as we win the war. I love you and Joel and Stella and think about you every minute of every day. Please give my love to them and to Flory. I am with Clay Wampler. His wife is Helen. Please contact her at 1427 Glenwood Road, Lamar, Colorado, and pass along this message. Love, Pete." He addressed the envelope, gave no return address, sealed the letter, and handed the pencil to Clay. They puttered out of the harbor, the old diesel chugging along as if the day might be its last. They left no wake and were soon on the sea. Straight ahead and due west was Vietnam, 1,000 miles away. To the right was China, closer at 700 miles. Teofilo brewed a pot of strong coffee, and as they savored it, he prepared breakfast of rice, pandesal, and more grilled mackerel. Pete and Clay ate carefully. Amato's wife had baked ginger cookies, and for the first time in months, they tasted real sugar. Though they had not mentioned cigarettes, Amato produced a fresh pack of Lucky Strikes, somehow smuggled all the way from Manila, and the tobacco had never tasted better. After 2 hours, the boat found a school of tuna. As Amato and Tomas reeled them in, Teofilo clubbed them with a mallet until they were still, then gutted and cleaned them. Through a haze of tobacco smoke, Pete and Clay watched and marveled at their efficiency. At midday, Tomas turned the boat back toward Luzon. Its jagged mountain ranges had never been out of sight, and as they grew nearer, Amato gave them the plan. The boat finally stopped about 200 yards offshore along a deserted stretch of rocky shoreline. Teofilo inflated the raft that had saved their lives and helped them into it. Amato handed them a rucksack filled with food and water and wished them well. They saluted, offered their humblest thanks again, and cast off. Teofilo turned the boat around and headed back to sea. When Pete and Clay were out of sight, Amato took the two envelopes, ripped them into tiny pieces, and flung them into the ocean. His boat had been searched twice by the Japanese Navy, and he simply could not run the risk. They came from the cavalry and the infantry and were not competent with a boat of any size. The raft proved hard to navigate and crashed into some rocks. Pete managed to keep the rucksack dry as he and Clay scrambled over the rocks and came close to drowning. Once on dry soil, they waited. Hiding in the bush and watching their arrival was a Filipino named Acevedo. He sneaked into position behind them, whistled, and waved them over. Acevedo was just a kid in a straw hat, but his hardened face and lean body gave the clear impression that he was a seasoned guerrilla. Most important, he was heavily armed with a rifle strapped over his shoulder and pistols on both hips. In good English, he explained that they would hike on some dangerous trails into the mountains, and if all went well, they should reach the first camp by dark. Japs were everywhere, and it was imperative that they move fast and silently without a word. The bush immediately became a dense jungle with trails that only Acevedo could see. And all trails were headed up. After an hour of climbing, they stopped for a rest. Pete and Clay were exhausted. The thinning air didn't help. Pete asked if they could smoke, and Acevedo frowned and shook his head vehemently. He knew something of what they had endured, and it was obvious they were not strong. He promised to slacken the pace. He lied. They took off again. Even faster. He suddenly raised a hand, stopped cold, and ducked low. As they peeked over a ridge, they saw a road in the distance, and it was crammed with Japanese troop carriers on the move. They watched the convoy as they gasped for breath and said nothing. Moving again, they caught a break and descended into a narrow valley. At a creek, they stopped, while Acevedo scanned the area for the enemy. Seeing none, they quickly waded across and disappeared into the jungle. The terrain changed, and they began climbing again. When his calf muscles were burning and he was out of breath, Pete called for a break. They sat in a thicket and ate rice cakes and coconut cookies. In a soft voice, Acevedo said that his brother had been a Filipino scout and had died down on Bataan. His vow was to kill as many Japanese as possible before they killed him. So far, his body count was 11 known dead, and there were probably others. The Japs tortured and beheaded every guerrilla they caught, so it was part of the code that you never surrendered. Far better to blow your own brains out than to allow the Japs to do it their way. Clay asked when they might get guns, and he said there would be plenty at the camp. Food and water, too. The guerrillas were not well fed, but nobody was starving. The food energized them, and they were off again. As the sun began to dip behind the mountains, they came to a narrow trail, hugging the side of a steep hill. It was a treacherous walk over loose rocks. The wrong step could send them falling into a bottomless ravine. For about 50 yards, they were exposed. Halfway into the clearing, as they ducked low and tried not to stumble, shots rang out from the other side of the ravine. Snipers just waiting. Acevedo was hit in the head and fell backward. A bullet nicked Pete's right sleeve, barely missing his chest. He and Clay jumped into the ravine as bullets landed around them. They tumbled violently downward, bouncing off saplings and tearing through the bush. Clay managed to snatch a vine and stop his fall, but Pete continued down, head over heels. He crashed into a dowel tree and almost lost consciousness. Clay could barely see the back of Pete's shirt and managed to slide down on his rear. When they were together, they took stock and counted no broken bones, yet. Their faces and arms were scratched and bleeding, but the cuts were not deep. Pete had taken a blow to the head and was groggy, but after a moment was ready to move on. They heard voices, and not in English. The enemy looking for them. As quietly as possible, they continued down, but in doing so, knocked stones loose and made a racket. At the bottom, near a creek, they ducked into a thicket of brush and stickers and waited. Something was splashing in the water. Three privates, with rifles at the ready, were wading their way. They walked within 10 feet of Pete and Clay, who lay still and barely breathed. An hour passed, maybe two, and the ravine grew dark. In whispers, they discussed the insane idea of climbing back up and looking for the rucksack and possibly Acevedo. They were sure he was dead, but they needed his guns. They knew the Japanese would not simply give up and return to their camp. The trophy of two American heads was too tempting, so Pete and Clay didn't move. Alone, deserted, unarmed, hunted with no idea of where they were or where they might be headed, they spent the sleepless night covered with insects, bugs, lizards, sticker cuts, and prayed the pythons and cobras would stay away. At one point, Pete asked who had had the bright idea of becoming guerrilla fighters. Clay chuckled and swore that he had never had such a ridiculous thought. At dawn, they had to move. Hunger returned with a vengeance. They drank from the creek and decided to follow it. To where, they had no clue. Throughout the day, they moved in shadows, never for a second leaving themselves exposed. Twice they heard voices and soon realized that they would have to move at night and rest during the day. Move to where, exactly? The creek fed into a narrow river, and from the bush, they watched a Japanese patrol boat drift by. 6 men with rifles, 2 with binoculars, all scouring the shorelines in search of someone. Late in the afternoon, they stumbled upon a foot trail and decided to follow it after dark. They were not sure where to go, but their current location was too dangerous. The trail was impossible to follow in the blackness of the night. They soon lost it, walked in circles, found it again, then gave up when they lost it again. They bedded down under a formation of rocks and tried to sleep. When they awoke in the early morning, a thick mist had settled through the jungle. It provided cover, and they soon found another footpath that was barely noticeable. After they had climbed for 2 hours, the sun burned away the mist and the trail widened. They were exhausted and starving when they came to a cliff over a steep and rocky ravine. 100 feet below was a creek filled with boulders. They rested in the shade, looked down at the creek, and discussed the possibility of simply jumping. Death would be better than the torture they were enduring. At that moment, death would be welcome. Their chances of survival were non-existent anyway. If they jumped, they would at least die at their own hands. Gunfire erupted not too far away, and they forgot about suicide. Gunfire meant the two sides had found each other. There were guerrillas close by. The gunfight lasted only a minute or so, but inspired them to keep walking. The trail turned down, and they crept along it, always with their heads low, always looking for a break in the bush that would expose them. They found a creek with clear water and refreshed themselves. They rested for an hour and moved on. When the sun was directly above them, they came to a clearing. In its center was a small fire that was still smoldering. Sitting against a large boulder was a Japanese soldier, apparently taking a nap. From the bush, they studied him for a long time and noticed blood on both legs. Evidently, he had been wounded and left behind by his unit. Occasionally, his right arm moved, proof that he was alive. Without a sound, Pete moved through the cover of the bush, while Clay inched closer behind trees. Pete climbed the boulder, and when he was directly above the target, he lifted a 10-pound rock and lunged. The rock landed squarely on top of the Jap's head. Clay was on him in an instant. Pete struck him again with the rock, while Clay grabbed his rifle and gutted him with the bayonet. They dragged him into the bush and ripped open his backpack. Tins of sardines, salmon, and mackerel, along with a packet of dried beef. They ate quickly, their shirts and hands covered with his blood. They hid his body in a thicket and hustled away from the clearing. For the first time in months, they were now armed. Clay carried the Arisaka rifle with the bayonet, along with his canteen. Pete wore his holster with a semi-automatic Nambu pistol. In the belt, he stuffed 30 cartridges, 2 magazines, and a 6-inch knife. They ran for an hour before stopping to rest and devouring another 10 of sardines. If captured now, they would be tortured and beheaded on the spot. Capture, though, would not happen. With bloody hands, they shook and made a pact that neither would be taken alive. If surrounded, they would shoot themselves with the pistol. Pete first, then Clay. They pressed on, climbing again. They heard gunfire again, heavy at times, a more prolonged skirmish than before. They could not decide if they should move toward it or away. So they waited, hiding beside the trail. The gunfire faded, then stopped. An hour passed, and the sun began to fade in the west. At a turn in the trail, they came face to face with a young Filipino who was sprinting in their direction. He was slight, skinny, sweating from his run, and unarmed. He stopped cold and wasn't sure about the strangers. Pete said, "Americans." The teenager stepped closer and looked at their weapons. "Japanese," he said, nodding at the bayonet. Clay smiled, pointed to the blood on his hands and arms, and said, "No. This is Japanese blood." The boy smiled and said, "American soldiers?" They nodded. Pete said, "We need to find the guerrillas. Can you take us to them?" His smile widened and he proudly drawled, "Aw, shit, where y'all from?" Pete and Clay exploded with laughter. Clay bent double and dropped his new rifle. Pete laughed and shook his head in disbelief. He had the image of this Filipino kid sitting around a campfire with a bunch of Americans having too much fun teaching him their brand of colorful English. Without a doubt, there were some boys from Texas or Alabama in the gang. When the laughter passed, the kid said, "Follow me. About an hour." "Let's go," Pete said, "but not so fast." The kid was called a runner, one of hundreds used for communication by the guerrillas who had almost no radios. The runners often carried written messages and orders. They knew the trails intimately and were rarely caught. But if that happened, they were tortured for information and killed. They climbed again for a long time as the air continued to thin. The break in the heat was welcome, but Pete and Clay struggled to keep up. As they approached the first bivouac point, the kid whistled three times, waited, heard something that Pete and Clay did not, and continued. They were on guerrilla turf now, and as safe as any American soldier could be in the Philippines. Two heavily armed Filipinos appeared from nowhere and waved them through. They passed through a tiny barrio where the people barely noticed them. The trail led to the first camp, where more Filipino guerrillas were cooking over a small fire. There were about 20 of them, living in lean-tos and preparing for the night. At the sight of the two Americans, they stood and saluted. Half an hour later, still climbing, they walked into a small compound hidden under a dense jungle canopy. An American in faded fatigues and fresh combat boots greeted them, Captain Darrell Barney, formerly of the 11th Infantry Brigade, but now of the unofficial West Luzon Resistance Force. After introductions were made, Barney yelled at a row of bamboo huts, and other Americans came forth. There were a lot of smiles, handshakes, backslapping, congratulations, and soon enough Pete and Clay were seated at a split bamboo table and served rice, potatoes, and grilled pork chops, a delicacy reserved for special occasions. As they ate, they were peppered with questions from around the table. The biggest talker was Alan Dubose from Slidell, Louisiana, and he proudly admitted that he was indeed teaching the Filipinos all manner of American slang. In all, there were six Americans, in addition to Pete and Clay, and none of the others had been on Bataan. After the surrender, they had fled to the mountains from other parts of the islands. They were far healthier, though malaria was everywhere. The Americans had heard about the death march, and they wanted the stories, all of them. For hours, Pete and Clay talked and talked and laughed and reveled in the safety of their surroundings. For two soldiers who had seen so much, it was at times difficult to fathom the fact that they were with American soldiers who were still fighting. Pete savored the moment, but he could not stop the flashbacks to O'Donnell. He thought about the men he knew there, many of whom would not leave alive. They were still starving while he feasted. He thought about the boneyard and the hundreds of starved corpses he had buried. He thought about the hell ship and heard the screams of the trapped men as they went under. One moment he enjoyed the food and banter and soothing American English with its variety of accents, and the next moment he sat muted, unable to eat, as another nightmare flooded his memory. The flashbacks, nightmares, and horrors would never go away. Late in the evening, they were led to the showers and given bars of soap. The water was lukewarm and felt marvelous. At first, they wanted to shave, but every other American had a heavy beard, so they passed on the opportunity. They were given underwear and clean socks and mismatched army fatigues, though in the bush, there were no established uniforms. The doctor, also an American, examined them and noted the obvious problems. He had plenty of medicines and promised them that after a couple of weeks, they would be ready to fight. They were shown to a bamboo hut, their new barracks, and given real cots with blankets. In the morning, they would meet their commander and be given more guns than they could carry. Alone in the darkness, they whispered of home, which seemed closer than ever. Chapter 31. The West Luzon Resistance Force was under the firm command of General Bernard Granger, a British hero from World War I. Granger was about 60, lean and tough and military to the core. He had lived in the Philippines for the past 20 years and at one time owned a large coffee plantation that the Japanese confiscated, killing two of his sons in the process and forcing him to flee to the mountains with his wife and what was left of his family. They lived in a bunker deeper in the jungle, and from there he commanded his force. His men adored him and referred to him as Lord Granger. He was at his desk under a canopy of camouflage netting when Pete and Clay were ushered in and introduced. He sent his aides away, though his bodyguard stayed close. He welcomed the Americans in his high-pitched, very proper British cadence and ordered a round of tea. Pete and Clay sat in bamboo chairs and admired him from the first moment. At times, his left eye was partially hidden by a crease in his smart safari hat. When he spoke, he removed the stem of a corncob pipe, and when he listened, he stuck it between his teeth and chewed it as if digesting every word. "I hear you've survived the nastiness down on Bataan," he said in his sing-song voice. "Probably worse than we've heard." They nodded and described it for a few moments. Bataan was brutal, but O'Donnell was worse. "And the Nips are shipping off boys to the coal mines back home, I hear," Granger said as he poured tea in porcelain cups. Pete described the hell ship and their rescue at sea. "We'll get the bloody bastards eventually," Granger said. "If they don't get us first, I hope you realize that your odds of survival have improved. But in the end, we're all dead men."
"Better to go down fighting," Clay said.
"That's the spirit. Our job is to create enough mischief to hamstring the Nips and prove that these islands are worth saving. We fear that the Allies might try to beat them without bothering with us. The High Command thinks it can bypass these islands and hit Japan, and it's entirely possible, you know. But MacArthur promised to return, and that's what keeps us going. Our Filipino boys must have something to fight for. It's their property to begin with. Milk and sugar?"
Pete and Clay declined. They would have preferred strong coffee, but they were still thankful for the large breakfast. Granger chatted on, then abruptly stopped and looked at Pete.
"So, what's the skinny on you?"
Pete went through a short bio. West Point, 7 years active in the 26th Cavalry, then sort of a forced retirement for personal reasons. Had to save the family farm. Wife and two kids back in Mississippi. Rank of first lieutenant. Granger's eyes danced and never blinked as he caught and analyzed every word.
"So you can ride a horse?"
"With or without a saddle," Pete said.
"I've heard of the 26th. Expert marksman, I take it."
"Yes, sir."
"We need snipers. Never enough snipers."
"Give me a rifle."
"You were at Fort Stotzenberg?"
"Yes, but only briefly, before December."
"Bloody Nips are using the base there for their Zeros and dive bombers. Heavier stuff they moved out after Corregidor. I'd like to hit some planes on the ground, but we haven't put together a plan yet." "And you?"
he asked, looking at Clay. "Enlisted in 1940, 31st Infantry, mortar specialist, rank of sergeant, a cowboy from Colorado who could also ride and shoot."
"Jolly good. I like men who want to fight. Sad to say, but we have some Americans here who are simply hiding with us and want to go home. Some are mad. Some are too sick. Some went AWOL from their units and wandered through the jungles, I suspect. They're dead weight, to be honest, but we can't exactly run them off. The first lesson you'll learn is to not ask questions of the others. Everyone has a story, and the cowards never tell the truth.
He sipped his tea and pulled out a map.
A bit about our operations. We're here in the middle of the Zambales Mountains. Really rugged terrain, as I'm sure you've learnt. Elevation of 9,000 feet in places. We have about 1,000 fighters scattered over 100 square miles. If we dug in and hid, we could last for a long time. But digging in is not in our cards. We are guerrillas, and we fight dirty. Never in frontal assaults, never in the open. We strike quick and disappear. The NIPS radar camps at the lower elevations, and it's very dangerous down there. You'll find out soon enough. We're gaining in numbers as more Filipinos run for the hills, and after a rough start, we're finally landing some punches.
So you don't worry about the Japs coming here? Pete asked.
We worry about everything. We pack light, always ready to pull back at the slightest danger. We can't fight them one-on-one. We have almost no artillery, save for a few mortars and light cannons, goodies we stole from the enemy. We have plenty of rifles, pistols, and machine guns, but no trucks or carriers. We're foot soldiers, with the advantage of the terrain. Our biggest problem is communication. We have a few old radios, nothing portable, and can't use them because the NIPS are always listening. So we rely on runners to coordinate things. We have no contact with MacArthur, though he knows we're here and fighting. To answer your question, we are relatively safe here, but always in danger. The NIPS would bomb us from the air if they could see us. Come along, and I'll show you our goodies.
Granger sprang to his feet, grabbed his walking stick, and took off. He rattled something in Tagalog to his guards, and they sprinted in front of him. Others followed as they left the camp and started up a narrow trail. As they walked, Granger said,
"The 26th, quite an outfit. Don't suppose you know Edwin Ramsey?"
"He was my commander," Pete said proudly.
"You don't say, bloody good soldier. He refused to surrender and headed for the hills. He's about 100 miles from here and organizing like mad. Rumor is that he has over 5,000 men in central Luzon and plenty of contacts in Manila."
They turned a corner, and two sentries pulled back a wall of vines and roots. They entered a cave.
"Get the torches,"
Granger barked, and two guards lit the way. The cave became a cavern, an open room with stalactites dripping water from above. Candles were lit along the walls, and the scope of the armory came into focus. Granger never stopped talking.
"Supplies left behind by the Yanks and taken from the NIPS. I'd like to think we have a bullet for every one of the bloody bastards."
There were pallets of ammunition, crates of rifles, stockpiles of canned food and water, thick bags of rice, barrels of gasoline, stacks of boxes holding supplies that were not identified. Granger said,
"Down the hall, in another room, we have 2 tons of dynamite and TNT. Don't suppose you have any experience with explosives?"
"No," Pete said. Clay shook his head.
"Too bad. We're in dire need of a good bomb boy. Last one blew himself up. A Filipino, and a damned fine one. But one will come along. Seen enough."
Before they answered, he whirled around. The tour was over. Pete and Clay were shocked at the stash of supplies, but also greatly comforted by it. They followed Granger out of the cave and began their descent. They stopped at an overlook and took in a stunning vista of waves of mountains that went on forever. The general said,
"The NIPS won't get this far, really. They're afraid to. And they know that we are forced to come down for the fight. So we do. Questions?"
Clay asked, "When do we fight?"
Granger laughed and said,
"I like that. Sick and malnourished, but ready for battle. A week or so. Give the doctors some time to fatten you up, and you'll soon see all the blood you want."
For the next 2 days, Pete and Clay lay about in luxury, napping and eating and drinking all the water they could hold. The doctors plied them with pills and vitamins. When they were finally bored, they were outfitted with rifles and pistols and taken to a firing range for a round of practice. A Filipino veteran named Camacho was assigned to them, and he taught them the ways of the jungle, how to build a small fire to cook, always at night because the smoke could not be seen, how to build a lean-to out of vines and shrub to sleep under in the rain, how to pack a rucksack with only the essentials, how to keep their guns and ammo dry, how to handle an angry cobra and a hungry python as well, how to do 100 essentials that might one day save their lives. On the third day, Pete was summoned to Lord Granger's post for tea and cards. They sat at a game board and chatted, with the general doing the bulk of the talking.
"Ever play cribbage?" he asked as he pulled out a deck of cards.
"Sure. I played it at Fort Riley."
"Bloody good. I have a round each afternoon at 3 with tea. Relaxes the soul."
He shuffled as he talked and dealt the cards.
"Two nights ago, the Nips raided an advance post a good ways down the mountain, one that is well defended. They surprised us with a large unit. There was a nasty fight. We lost. They were looking for Bobby Lipman, a tough major from Brooklyn, and they found him, along with two other Americans. The Filipinos in the unit were either killed in battle or beheaded on the spot. That's a favorite of the Nips. Whack off the heads and leave them lying near the bodies to frighten the neighbors. Anyway, Lipman and the other Americans were taken to a prison in Manila to have a chat with some of the Nips' toughest interrogators. I'm told that some of these officers speak the King's English better than most Brits. Lipman's in for a nasty time. They'll whip him and burn him for a few days. They have a variety of methods, and if he talks, we could feel it here. If he doesn't, and I doubt he will, then they'll have a little ceremony for him that involves one of those long swords you've seen. It's a war banning. And as you've seen, there are many ways to kill."
"I thought there were bivouacs and rings of sentries at each post," Pete said. "How did they pull a surprise?"
"We'll never know. Their favorite trick is to bribe a local, some Filipino who needs money or rice, and is willing to sell information. As the Nips close the noose, we're starting to see less food. In some villages, the peasants are skipping meals. The Nips know how to bribe. We have many posts in these mountains. Sometimes we stay in them, sometimes we don't. But there are safe houses. If we're in for the night, or perhaps a week, the locals usually find out. It's rather easy to find a Nip and sell the intel. Are you ready for combat?"
"Damn right I am."
"The doctor says you're in reasonably good shape. Hell, we're all underweight and sick with something, but you and Clay look especially gaunt. Suppose you've seen the worst of it."
"We're fine, and we're bored. Give us an assignment."
"The two of you will go with Dubose, a squad of about 10. Camacho will always be with you, and he's the best. You'll leave in the middle of the night, hike 3 or 4 hours, have a look. It's part recon, part assault. If Lipman is talking under duress, we should know it by what the Nips do and where they go. After a couple of days on the trails, you'll hook up with another unit, some of our boys from another mountain. They've borrowed a bomb maker who'll string some wires and such. The target is a convoy. Should be an easy job. And you'll get to shoot some Nips. Jolly good fun."
"I can't wait."
"Assuming all goes well, the bomb maker is willing to spend some time with you boys and teach you how to play with TNT. Listen and learn."
As Pete shuffled and dealt, Granger reloaded his pipe with tobacco and managed to do so without missing a word.
"Poor Lipman. All of us vow that we'll not be taken alive. It's a far better thing to put a bullet in one's head than let the Nips have their way. But it's not always that easy. Men are often wounded first and unable to shoot themselves. Sometimes they're asleep and surprised, and often banning. I think that we become so adept at survival that we believe we can survive anything. So we drop our guns, raise our hands, and are led away. Usually, I suppose, within hours, there is an awful feeling of regret. You ever come close to ending it all?
Many times, Pete said. The thirst and hunger drove us all crazy, along with the constant killing. I thought that if I could only go to sleep, then I would pass on the bit about waking up. But we survived. We're surviving now. I plan to get home, General.
Attaboy! But don't let the Nips take you alive. Hear me?
Don't worry.
Chapter 32. They left the camp shortly after midnight, 10 guerrillas in all, following two runners who could find the trails in their sleep. 6 Filipinos and 4 Americans, all heavily armed and loaded with backpacks full of tinned food, canned water, blankets, tarps, and all the ammo they could carry. Mercifully, all movements were downward. The first lesson Pete and Clay learned was to concentrate on the boots of the man in front of them. Looking around was fruitless because there was nothing to see in the blackness. A missed step could cause a stumble and a fall and an uncertain landing. For the first hour, nothing was said. As they approached the first barrio, a lookout greeted them. In an unknown dialect, he informed Camacho that all was well. They had not seen the enemy in days. The squad circled around the huts and kept moving. There was no lookout at the second barrio, and not a sound from the settlement. After 3 hours, the ground leveled, and they stopped at an advance post, 4 shelters built into the bush and empty. They rested for half an hour and snacked on sardines and water. Dubose drifted over and asked quietly, "Y'all doing all right?" Pete and Clay assured him that they were having fun, though they were already fatigued. The others looked like they were just warming up. Off again, they began to climb, and after an hour stopped again to rest. Dubose knew what his 2 rookies had been through and wanted to protect them. The squad descended into a ravine, waded across a creek, and came upon a large barrio. From the bush, they watched the area for a few minutes, then Camacho ventured forth and found the lookout. Again, there had been no sign of the enemy. As they waited, Dubose eased beside Pete and drawled,
"Folks here are pretty safe. Each little village is run by a boss, and the one here is a solid guy. From here, though, it's no man's land."
"Where's the road?" Pete asked.
"Not far."
At daybreak, they were hiding in a ditch beside a dirt highway that was obviously well used. They heard movements on the other side, then silence. Someone said,
"Dubose?"
He answered,
"Over here."
Head suddenly popped out of the brush, and an American named Carlisle stepped forward. He commanded a dozen men, including 3 Yanks with mangy beards and the same weather-beaten look. They hurried to retrieve wooden boxes filled with more TNT, and for an hour, they laid the explosives and ran wires to the detonators. The bomb maker was a Filipino veteran who had obviously laid many traps. When the TNT was in place, the men retreated to the bush, with Dubose assigning positions. Pete, the sniper, hid behind some rocks and was instructed to shoot anything that moved. Clay was given a light machine gun and positioned 50 yards away. Camacho stayed close to Pete and whispered as the sun rose. The Japanese were moving tons of supplies inland on many routes, and their mission was to harass and disrupt the line. Spies at the port had sent word that a convoy of 4 or 5 trucks was on the way. They had no idea of the cargo, but blowing it up would be a thrill. You'll see. As he waited,
Pete's trigger finger itched as his stomach flipped in anticipation. It had been months since he had been in combat, and the waiting was nerve-wracking. When he heard the rumble of trucks, Camacho said, "Get ready." 4 of them. The lead and rear trucks were filled with troops to protect the cargo in the middle 2. The guerrillas waited and waited, and for a long moment, Pete thought the explosives would not work. But when they did, the ground shook with such a fury that Pete was thrown against the rocks. The lead truck flipped like a toy, slinging soldiers into the air. The 3rd and 4th trucks were blown onto their sides. Gunfire exploded from the bush as 2 dozen hidden guerrillas unloaded a brutal barrage. The Japs who had survived the explosions crawled and staggered, and most were shot before they could fire a shot. The driver of the 2nd truck crawled through the shattered front window, and Pete picked him off. Clay was in a nest to the rear of the convoy with a direct line of fire into the troop carrier. Using a Japanese Type 99 lightweight machine gun, he mowed down one Jap after another as they tried to crawl out and find their weapons. Several of them took cover behind the trucks, but were shot in the back by guerrillas on the other side of the road. There was no place to hide. The gunfire was withering and went on for a good 5 minutes. One Jap managed to hide between trucks 2 and 3 and spray a few rounds into the trees before being hit high and low. Slowly, the shooting came to a halt. During a lull, they watched and waited, hoping a Jap on the ground would move for a weapon. All was still as the dust began to settle. Dubose and Carlisle crept forward and waved their men back onto the road. Every Jap, dying or already dead, got an extra bullet to the head. Prisoners were nothing but baggage. There was no place to hold them and no extra food to feed them. In this version of the war, neither side took prisoners, unless American officers were captured. Their deaths were delayed. Dubose and Carlisle barked orders with a sense of urgency. 2 Filipinos were sent back down the road to watch for more trucks. 2 were sent ahead. The dead bodies, 37 of them, were stripped of weapons and backpacks. Luckily, the 2nd supply truck had not been disabled. It had been packed with boxes of rifles, grenades, machine guns, and unbelievably, hundreds of pounds of TNT. In every ambush, there is a miracle, and the fact that a stray bullet had not hit the explosives was a gift. The 1st supply truck was on its side and a total wreck. It was filled with boxes of rations. Dubose made the decision to pack as much food as possible in with the armaments and use the 2nd truck for their getaway. Stepping over dead bodies and kicking them out of the way, the guerrillas managed to roll the 1st truck into a ditch. With a Filipino behind the wheel, the 2nd truck limped away. Pete and 5 others sat on top of it, their butts just inches above tons of explosives. As they turned a corner, the men looked back with great satisfaction at the mayhem they had caused. 3 smoldering trucks, piles of dead bodies, and not a single wounded soldier on their side. Japanese Zeros routinely watched the roads at an altitude that seemed just inches above the trees, and it was only a matter of time before they arrived. Dubose wanted to get off the road before they were spotted, and a Zero hit the truck and blew them all to bits. The pilots would see the carnage, know immediately what had happened, and attack with a vengeance. Their driver turned into a clearing and gunned the engine. The truck was exposed until it found a parking spot under a canopy of thick trees. It stopped, and Dubose ordered the men to quickly cover it with vines and brush. When it couldn't be seen from 20 feet away on the ground, the men retreated to the shade and tore into the Japanese backpacks. They feasted on tins of fish and loaves of hard rice bread. One Jap, obviously a guy with a drinking problem, had been carrying 4 cans of sake, and the break became an impromptu cocktail hour. While their troops had a drink, Dubose and Carlisle huddled by the truck.
Their discussion was interrupted by the unmistakable, high-pitched whining of approaching Zeros. Two of them swooped low over the highway, then pulled up fierce vertical ascents. They circled back for another look and disappeared. There was talk of returning to the road and to the wreckage. The spot had proven perfect for the ambush, and the Japs would undoubtedly send a large search party. The killing had been so easy, the body count so impressive, it was tempting to go back for more. But Dubose thought better of it. Their job was to hit and run, not to plan offensives. Besides, at that moment, the contraband was far more important than a few more dead Japs. The truck could not handle the mountain trails, and Dubose made the decision to unload it and devise a scheme to transfer the goodies back to their base. Since his men certainly couldn't carry it all, he sent a dozen Filipinos into the nearest barrios to barter for oxen and pack mules. They offered plenty of food for the rentals of the animals. The party ended abruptly when Dubose ordered the remaining men to begin the arduous task of unloading. After noon, a few oxen and mules began to appear, not nearly enough, but a good number of local men had agreed to swap their labor for food. The first elements of the convoy had just disappeared into the bush when a runner sprinted from a trail with the news that a large unit of Japanese soldiers was just around the corner. Without hesitation, Dubose ordered the bomb maker to rig the truck and the explosive still on board. He and Carlisle agreed that the wreckage would block the road, giving them some extra time. The guerrillas uncovered the truck so the Japs could find it, then retreated into the bush and waited. The advance team arrived on motorcycles, saw the truck, and got excited. Before long, three troop carriers stopped and dozens of soldiers spilled out, all crouching low in anticipation of another ambush. There was none, and they advanced slowly upon the truck. When they realized the enemy was gone, they relaxed and milled around the truck, all yakking with great concern. When their officer strutted forward and stepped into the truck for a quick look, the bomb maker pulled a wire from 100 feet away. The explosion was magnificent and sent dozens of bodies flying. Dubose and his men admired it with a quick laugh, then scurried back to their trails. Each man was now laden with as much gear and stolen armaments as possible, and they were climbing again. Pete and Clay were fatigued to the point of collapse, but they trudged on. They had marched under much worse conditions, and they knew their weak bodies could endure the hardship. Well after dark, they arrived at their first advance post, and everyone collapsed. Runners had reported to Lord Granger, and he sent more men to help with the haul. Dubose called it a day and ordered them to set up camp. More runners arrived with the welcome news that they were not being followed. The men ate until they were full and even managed another shot of sake. Pete and Clay found a spot on the dirt floor of a hut and relived the glory of the day. Their whispers soon faded and they fell fast asleep. For 2 days, the convoy climbed over the mountains, stopping often to rest and eat. Twice, they were diverted when runners warned them that the enemy was near, searching in full force. Zeros patrolled the skies like angry wasps, itching to strafe something, but seeing nothing. The men took cover in ravines and caves. When they finally arrived home, Lord Granger was waiting on them with a smile and a hug for every man. Splendid work, boys. Splendid work. Other than blistered feet and aching muscles, not a single man had been wounded. They rested for days until they were bored again. The rainy season arrived in a fury when a typhoon swept through the northern Philippines. Torrents of rain pounded the mountains, and the winds ripped the roofs off of bamboo huts. At its peak, the men retreated to the caves and hunkered down for 2 days.
The trails turned to mud, and many were impassable. But the war raged on, and the Japanese had no choice but to continue moving men and supplies. Their convoys were often mired in knee-deep mud and stalled for long periods. They became easy targets for the guerrillas, who moved on foot, though not as quickly. Granger kept his squads busy, hitting targets with brutal strikes, then disappearing into the bush. Japanese reprisals were vicious, and the civilians paid the price. Pete was given his own squad, G Troop, 20 men that included Clay and Camacho, and he was promoted to the rank of major in the West Luzon Resistance Force. Such a position would not be officially recognized by the real army, but then the real army had retreated with MacArthur to Australia. Lord Granger ruled his own force and promoted as he saw fit. After a successful raid on a convoy, Major Banning and his men were withdrawing when they approached a barrio. They smelled smoke from the trail and soon came upon a horrible scene. The Japanese had raided and destroyed the village. Every hut was on fire, and children were running everywhere, screaming. In the center, there were about 15 dead men, all with their hands tied behind their backs. Their bodies were bloodied and mutilated. Their detached heads were a few feet away, lined in a neat row. Several women had been shot, and they lay where they fell. A teenage boy bolted from the bush and ran toward them, crying and screaming. Camacho grabbed him and spoke to him in a dialect. As the boy wailed, he shook his fists angrily at the guerrillas. Camacho said, "He blames us, says we brought the Japanese here." Camacho kept talking to the boy, who was inconsolable. "He says the Japanese came here a few hours ago and accused the people of helping the Americans. They demanded to know where the Americans were hiding. And since we didn't know and couldn't tell them, they did this. Both his mother and his father were murdered. They took his sister and some of the young women away. They raped them and then killed them too." Pete and his men were speechless. They listened to the exchange and gawked at the carnage. Camacho went on. "He said his brother went to find the Japanese and tell them that you're here. It's all your fault. All your fault. The Americans are to blame." Pete said, "Tell them we're fighting the Japanese. We hate them too. We're on the side of the Filipinos." Camacho jabbered on, but the boy was out of his mind. He was bawling and kept shaking his fist at Pete. He finally tore away and ran to the dead men. He pointed at one and screamed at the corpse. Camacho said, "That's his father. They were forced to watch as the Japs cut off their heads, one at a time, while threatening to kill all of them if they didn't give up the information." The boy ran to the bush and disappeared. Children were clinging to the bodies of their mothers. The huts were still burning. The guerrillas wanted to help in some way, but the situation was too dangerous. Pete said, "Let's get out of here." They hurried away, sloshing through the mud. They marched until dark as heavy rain began, then set up camp under leaking lean-tos and tarps. The rain was unrelenting, and they slept little. Pete had nightmares about the ghoulish scene. Back at the base, he reported to Lord Granger and described the raid on the barrio. Granger refused to show emotion, but he knew Major Banning was rattled. He ordered him to rest for a few days. Around the fire that night, Pete and Clay told the story to the other Americans. They had their own stories, and they had grown callous to such tales. The enemy had a limitless capacity for savagery, and it made the guerrillas vow to fight even harder. Chapter 33. In Pete's absence, the cotton grew anyway, and by mid-September, the picking began. The weather cooperated, the prices held firm on the Memphis Exchange, The field hands worked from dawn to dusk, and Buford managed to keep enough itinerant labor in